What's up, everyone? You're probably wondering what this gruesome photo is doing on the second page of your source sheet. So let's begin with this photo right now. And if anyone does not have, there should be some more up front. Any source sheets being passed around? This picture won the Pulitzer Prize for photojournalism in 1969. It was voted one of the five pictures that changed the 20th century. Very influential picture. What is it a picture of? It is the photographer, Eddie Adams, captured the precise moment that Brigadier General Nguyen Ngoc Lon, who was the police chief of South Vietnam, executed a Viet Cong prisoner at arm's length, literally blowing his brains out. This picture made its way into every newspaper in the world and inspired, according to many, the anti-war movement, the anti-Vietnam War movement in the United States. It showed us Americans as siding with the callous South Vietnamese against the poor, defenseless North Vietnamese. This was taken at the height of the Tet Offensive when tensions were quite high on both sides, and it really galvanized the anti-war movement. And it's very easy to look at this picture, which captures a split second of history, and condemn the executioner and show him as executing an innocent person. After all, he's the man holding the gun, and he's pointing it at someone very defenseless. And that is how the world took it. But I share it with you because the photographer, Eddie Adams, wrote afterwards that he regretted ever taking this picture, and he wished that he had never been there to see it. Because the real story, the story that the picture does not show, is what happened before this picture was taken, which was the man on the right, the defenseless-looking man in the plaid shirt, had just killed the other man's best friend and his wife and six children in a cowardly act. And the man on the left had no choice but to kill him as punishment, and also so the morale of his entire group of people would not plummet. In fact, Eddie Adams wrote the following words: "How do you know that you wouldn't have pulled the trigger yourself had you been there? The picture only captures a split second of time. But a person has to become a maven. A person has to know what happens before what he sees to appreciate what is happening. If we are willing to condemn someone for murder based on this photo, then certainly we condemn people for many other things in our daily lives. And if someone can be exonerated for murder just by knowing a little bit about what happened, certainly it is our mission to exonerate those who we have condemned in our minds. And that is the purpose of why we are here tonight. To learn more about being down the cop's cuss, to judge the side of innocence. The man on the left, General Lone, acted as many of us would have acted. And he should not be condemned. And the movement his photo inspired probably had a false start because of this photo's popularity. What motivates each person is a great mystery, and we often have to be mind readers to see what is happening behind people's actions. And that's why we are here tonight. We're training ourselves for the second time in the ACT cycle in the art and science of being down the chafschus, judging for the side of innocence, which is a very Jewish attribute. Now, why am I here specifically, someone who is not particularly good at being down the chafschus? First of all, Phil Rosen is very persistent, does not take no for an answer. Second of all, because I often fail at being down the chafschus, I'm here to be mechazik myself, and hopefully as I'm giving myself tips, you can listen in on the tips to myself. Often rabbis are unfortunately put in the position to constantly judge others, and we have to be more aware than anyone else about why we are doing it and how we are doing it. And the truth is, life is a courtroom. The title of the class is Entering the Courtroom of the Mind. And judging is not just for a courtroom. Every second of life, we are judging everyone around us, whether we know it or not. Certainly, we're very good at judging other drivers on the road. That we have no problem doing. He's too fast, he's too slow, made a bad turn. But even not in the car. Well, it's exacerbated in the car, certainly. But even not in the car, we're constantly judging others. And our prejudices, our biases, our loves and our hates, they all cloud our perception. And our goal is we have to reroute our thought patterns, which is something that is exceedingly difficult. It's not easy to do. So tonight we're going to see some sources and some stories that can help us be better judges on the side of innocence. We'll start with the source in the Torah for this. It is a very strange pasuk in Sefer Vayikra in Parshas Kedoshim, which says, "B'tzedek tishpot amitacha." Literally, with justice, you should judge your neighbor. "B'tzedek tishpot amitacha." It's a very vague pasuk, and the Gemara jumps right in and offers four interpretations of what this means. Three out of those four have to do with literally a judge in an actual courtroom. And one has nothing to do with the courtroom, and that's where the Gemara says in Masechta Shavuos, "Havidan es chavercha b'kafskos." One should judge their fellow Jew to the side of innocence. What does this mean? That means when it comes to judging our fellow Jews' actions, we should not be impartial, neutral, objective, but we should not withhold judgment either. Rather, we actually have to impose a positive bias on everyone around us. We don't have to say, I don't know how to judge him. We know how to judge someone in a positive light. Everything they do has a positive reason behind it. That is something that is hard to master, but it is our responsibility. In other words, if someone does something, and there are two possible ways to interpret that action, we have no choice but to interpret it in a positive light. We are obligated to do so. If, on the other hand, someone does something that we strain very hard, but we cannot possibly find an avenue of innocence for this person. We see it before our very eyes. We know what happened before and after. There's no other way to explain this but for the side of that he's doing something negative or bad. Then we don't have to be naive. We don't have to pretend we didn't see it, and we can judge this person for the side of guilt. However, it doesn't mean we have to upbraid that person in public. There are many mefarshim. I'll just share with you the comment of the Satmar Rebbe. The Satmar Rebbe looked at Avram Avinu. Avram Avinu went out and petitioned for the city of Sodom, an evil city. He did so by himself. He did it alone, without anyone around him. You don't want to publicly go out and demonstrate that people who are wrongdoers are okay to do so, but in private, Avram certainly tried his hardest to judge the city of Sodom l'kaf schus. If Avram can do that about an evil, idolatrous city, which had horrible moral crimes, certainly we can do that about our fellow Jews. It's difficult to understand why Hashem commanded us to do certain things. But what we can ask is, what benefit is it to us or society for this to be done? So let's focus right now on what benefit we can accrue to ourselves and our fellow Jewish world by judging for the side of innocence. First of all, the Maharshal, Rav Shlomo Luria, writes that when we judge for the side of innocence, that preserves a harmonious society. It minimizes animosity and strife. Imagine if we were all to be going around and just thinking bad things about what we're all doing. Who could be friends with each other? Who could be neighbors? Who could ever share close relationships and intimacies? Instead, by assuming that whatever someone does, he has a darn good reason behind it, and is in fact doing something that he feels is right, that helps us maintain a harmonious society and helps us all get along. Or we could say that when we judge for the side of innocence, we are actually fulfilling another mitzvah in Parshas Kedoshim, v'yahafel re'acha kamocha. Love your fellow Jew like yourself. After all, if we were in the shoes of the person being judged, and someone else were judging us, wouldn't we want that person to assume we were doing something innocent. So therefore, if we truly love our fellow Jew like ourselves, then we only must do what they would want to do, what we want them to do for us. And the love of a fellow Jew will help us get to the point of judging for the side of innocence. Alternatively, the Sefer Yireyim quotes another pasuk in Parshas Kedoshim: "Lo sisna es achicha bilvavecha." Do not hate your brother in your heart. Only someone who hates his fellow Jew will take pride or leap to judge him or her unfavorably. Our enemies are the people that we always assume bad things about. Our allies, our friends, those are the people we must assume something good about. And therefore, if one judges unfavorably without any other information, then we have also violated hating a fellow Jew. The Gemara in Masechah Shabbos makes a strange statement. The Gemara says, "He who judges favorably is himself judged favorably by God." Which is not easy to understand. Why should the way Hashem judges us be affected by what we do? Hashem is not going to judge us favorably if we don't. Certainly it's Midah Keneged Midah. But the Shita Mekubetzes, a commentary on the Gemara, says no, Hashem does not need this motivation. Hashem does not need to follow our lead. It's not that if we judge favorably others, He'll judge us favorably. No. But rather, Hashem does adopt the way the world runs. In other words, if the way a society functions is that they are generous in their assessment of others, then Hashem, not on an individual level, but in general, will be generous in his assessment of the world. Hashem follows the world's lead, not individuals' lead. And therefore, our goal is to have a whole society of people judging favorably, which will lead to Hashem treating society in a favorable light. There's a strange statement in the Talmud, which says, "Choshed b'ksherim loket b'gufo." One who suspects someone who's kosher, someone who's really a fit person, something negative. Someone goes and wrongly suspects a do-gooder of doing bad. Choshed b'ksherim, what's the punishment? Loke begufo. They get lashes. Literally lashes. So that's not really, you know, normally we don't give someone lashes for a sin of the heart or of the mind. In general, lashes in Jewish law are reserved for sins done with the body. You know, so the Maharal Prague in his Gur Aryeh says that's not what it means. It does not mean that if someone is choshed b'ksher, we find out that someone suspected someone of doing no good, we'll arrest him, bring him into court, and give him, that's not what it means. It means that someone who is choshed b'ksher, someone who's not dan l'chatzos, he'll go around and he'll create a vicious cycle of suspicion in society. Once again, societal view. If our whole community is constantly not judging favorably, assuming the worst of people, that will make the whole world acrimonious, will lead to debate, will lead to fighting, and will lead to this person being hit. Will lead to him being caught in a fight. Not that the court will actually give him lashes, but a person who judges unfavorably and thinks the worst of his fellow Jew, that makes the world an unsafe place for people. That makes us enemies instead of neighbors. And therefore, the ultimate result will be loke begufo. Not by the court, but by all the hatred that he has created in society. So, how are we supposed to go about preventing ourselves from doing this? So with that, we turn to the front page of your packet. We're going to analyze a very beautiful Mishnah from the first chapter of Pirkei Avos. Of course, we have noted that the source for Dan HaKasos is not Pirkei Avos, it's the Torah, it's the Chumash. But, nevertheless, in Pirkei Avos, the rabbis listed offer their top 10 list, their favorite concepts from the Torah. And what are their favorite concepts? Yehoshua ben Parachia ben Itai HaRbeli Kiblu Mehem. Yehoshua ben Parachia ben Itai HaRbeli received the Torah tradition from their predecessors. And what did Yehoshua ben Parachia say? He was fond of saying the following three adages: Aseh Lecha Rav, make for yourself a teacher; Ukneh Lecha Chaver, buy for yourself, acquire for yourself a friend; And you should judge all people on the scale of merit, or for the side of innocence. So let's analyze, through a Talmudic lens, a little more carefully, the statement of Rabbi Yeshua ben Prachya. If you recall, the Gemara didn't say those words. The Gemara said, "Havedan es chavercha lekafskos," judge your friend to the side of innocence. Yeshua ben Prachya twisted those words, and he said, "Havedan es kol ha'adam lekafskos." He substitutes the word chaver, friend, for adam, person. But not only that, it's not done as ha'adam, not done as ha'adam lekafskos. Don't judging people for the side of innocence. It's kol ha'adam, all of, not people, but all of the person. Kol ha'adam. So many mefarshim and Pirkei Avos point out that this is a hint to how to judge favorably. When we look at our fellow Jew and we analyze their actions, we have no other choice but to do so. We must not look at the person with a tunnel vision, but rather we look at kol ha'adam, at all of the person, not just what he's doing right now, but we should try to investigate all of the things that went into that person, kol ha'adam. Because as we see, even someone pulling the trigger on a gun might have a darn good reason for doing so that we didn't know. So before we declare this person's a Russia, it is very important for us to see kol ha'adam, all the circumstances, all of the history that went into this act that we think is bad. Kol ha'adam. That's one hint in the Mishnah. Secondly, there's a very good reason why Rabbi Yeshua ben Prachya preceded Dan Lekafskos with two other concepts. Aseh lecha rav, ukri lecha chaver. Acquire for yourself a teacher and a friend, and an associate. What is the best way to train ourselves to be Dan Lekafskos? With a rav and with a chaver. By having good role models and having good friends. In other words, involving yourself in a social and educational framework that allows you to be Dan Lekafskos. It's such a hard thing to do, you need a whole group of people around you doing the same thing in order to be successful. And that really, a little commercial message, that is what ACT is all about. ACT is not you as the individual trying to do this on your own, but rather you doing this along with a lot of other people. You reading the books, reading the stories, and listening to the lessons, to be doing all, being Dan Lekafskos with lots of other people. With Aseh Lecha Rav, with Ukri Lecha Chaver. So the stories that you will be reading in the book that will be read daily, those are your new friends. That's your new Rav. Those are the people who are giving you the inspiration to train yourself to be Dan Lekafskos properly. The good role models that we seek are all over. One of the famous Jews ever to live of Dan Lekafskos was the famous the Bar Dichever Rebbe, the Kedushas Levi. Any Bar Dichever story is how this great man could look at a person doing something that you think is bad, and he's an instant tzaddik. Everything this Jew does is from the goodness of his heart. No matter what no matter what his body is doing wrong, the Bar Dichever can see in him a positive light. But certainly any other book or story that we hear help us be Dan Lekafskos. So for example, in the Art Scroll, one of the Art Scroll Pirkei Avos on this Mishnah is recorded the following story that occurred in Ashdod, Israel, not too long ago. Ashdod is a city that is not known for its great wealth. There are many poverty-stricken people who live in Ashdod. It's an economically deprived town. And there was a man marrying off his daughter, and he did not have enough money for a wedding, so he had no choice. He had to go around to his friends to collect money for them in order to afford a wedding for his child. Well, lo and behold, the 2 months pass, and the invitation comes in the mail, and it turns out that the wedding is taking place at a rather fancy hall, which is surprising. And the guests all come to the wedding, and not only is the hall fancy, but what a lavish display of food and a five-piece orchestra. And it's an elaborate wedding. And it's a beautiful wedding, and the friends go home, and they're actually shocked. This is what we raise money for. This man is so poverty stricken that he's spending our money so wastefully. He should have done a modest wedding and saved the rest of the money for something more important. Education, clothing, food. Instead, he blows all the money that we gave him in 5 hours. Now, the truth is, many people who pay for weddings feel that way afterwards. But certainly, if someone goes around collecting money, they should not be in a position of making the fanciest wedding possible. So, for a couple of weeks thereafter, the parents, they're getting really strange looks around town. You know, everyone's staring at them, everyone's looking down in the store, in shul, getting uncomfortable looks. Finally, they come to the rabbi, and they say, "Listen, we were sworn to secrecy, but we have to tell you what's going on here because our good name has been ruined. We collected money from our friends. We had no money for this wedding. And then we took all that money, we went to the caterer to prepare a modest wedding. And the caterer looked at us, and he looked at my wife, and he said, 'I recognize you. What's your name?' 'Oh, such and such a name. Your grandfather saved my family from the Nazis. If not for your family, I wouldn't be here today. I'm going to make for you the most beautiful wedding possible at no cost.' So, Rabbi, we did not pay for this wedding except for what we collected. Everything else was extra. Everything was thrown in by the caterer for free. But they made us promise to not tell us all. They made us promise we couldn't tell anyone how we afforded such a wedding. But what's happening now is we're going around and everyone thinks we're Ganavim. Everybody thinks that we collected money under false pretenses and we're not really poor. What should we do?" So the caterer agreed that because the name of this family had been torn asunder, that they could now reveal quietly through the rabbi what had happened. Because otherwise this family's good name had been ruined. Every single guest at that wedding was guilty of being choshed b'ksherim, of not judging favorably. Imagine, it's a very hard thing to do. But those 100 people who went to the wedding, they had an obligation, and we probably would have done it also, to say, "Hey, we gave them the money, and maybe they got a really good deal. Maybe this is not real meat. Maybe it's fake. Who knows?" They had an obligation to assume. Maybe they're related to the band. So you have to be creative. You have to use your imagination in order to judge favorably. When it comes to areas of tzedakah, we're very challenged in this area. Anyone who knocks on the door and is asking for tzedakah, well, what do we look at first? Well, look in the driveway. What kind of car are they driving? Is it a car nicer than mine? Usually it is. What kind of clothes are they wearing? I can't afford a suit like that. You know, what do we do about that? So the truth is, we need to know. Many of the people who collect tzedakah, they don't own those cars. They borrow the cars from someone. There's a gemach in Brooklyn that has drivers and cars to go out for these purposes, and even lends out clothing for the purposes. So the guy might have a beautiful new suit and tie and drive a sleek black Lincoln Town Car, but it's not his. And therefore, he might very well be deserving of tzedakah, even though you think that he drives better than you. It's very common to be choshed b'ksherim in this issue. And I haven't found ways to always be good at it. You know, last year, typical Sunday morning, after Shacharis, there's a group of three men with beards collecting tzedakah in shul. And everyone in shul gave them a couple of dollars, and I gave them a little larger amount because, you know, from the rabbi's fund. And a half hour later, I got a call at my house from a member of the shul who spotted these three men at BB Big buying lottery tickets with the money. So this is very upsetting. Someone who's collecting money, they should not be spending that money on lottery tickets, in my opinion. I was very disturbed by this. So 4 weeks later, when the same crew arrived in the same car with the same driver and the same clothes, mind you, and they went around collecting, I met them in my office afterwards and I said, "You know, excuse me, but I can't give you any more." "Well, why not?" "Well, you were spotted buying lottery tickets at BB Big not 10 minutes after you left shul a month ago. I don't think that you should be spending that money, that you know, that hard-earned money, for the gamble, for the lottery tickets. And the man looked at me with utter sincerity, and he said, "But the jackpot was $100 million." So I was totally shocked. And what do you say to that? This challenged the Dalakoff's chus factor. You know, how do you deal with such a personality? So what you have to say is that this is a person with great bitachon and amuna. This is a person who really... No, he keeps coming back, so I don't know. I guess it didn't work that time. But this is a person who really believes that Hashem is going to help him. And he's going to strike a wish to enable himself to not have to schlep out on a Sunday morning and collect money. So our imagination has to be challenged, especially in those areas. The Baal Shem Tov has a beautiful lesson about this. The Baal Shem Tov reminds us of the story from the book of Shmuel Bet. I believe it's Perek Yud Aleph, where King David has just committed a sin with Bathsheba, the wife of Uriah Hachiti, and he has sent this man off the battle to be killed, and then he has taken his wife Bathsheba as his own. Sounds very bad from the Pesukim himself. The Talmud, the rabbis in the Talmud have many ways to explain that it's not as bad as it seemed, but let's just say it was a bad thing. Well, in the next chapter, Nasan HaNavi, Nasan the prophet, comes to visit David HaMelech with the following message. He tells him the story. Once upon a time, there is a man, a very poor man, who had only one adorable little lamb in his flock. And that lamb is what enabled him to support himself. And one day, the rich man, with thousands of cattle, came and stole the baby lamb from the poor person. David, that was a story that was told to David HaMelech. David was outraged. He said, "That man who stole the lamb should be put to death. What a horrible crime he committed for doing that to the man." And Nasan HaNavi looked at David and said, "Atah Ish, that's you. You are the man who did that. You took another man's wife, what was precious to him. And therefore, you are the one who's a sinner. You have now condemned yourself to great punishment." And David had no choice but to admit his guilt immediately to Hashem. The Baal Shem Tov comments about this story, that often we decide our own punishments for our own transgressions. In other words, just like the Navi showed David a scenario and caused David to judge that fictional man, the fictional rich man in the story, and thereby judged himself, so too, when we see others doing things that we think are wrong, we are in fact judging ourselves. For we have done those things that are wrong too. And we want people to judge us favorably. In other words, any time we see someone doing something not so good, that is in fact an opportunity to view how others view ourselves. And if we condemn that person, we are in fact condemning ourselves. All of the judging situations in which we are put are in fact microcosms or parables for our own behavior. And when we have our righteous indignation about what others' activities, we are in fact judging our own activities. Chanuch Teller tells the story of he travels frequently on business, and often he would see tzedakah collectors in the shuls to which he went, and there they are flying back to Israel in first class, King David Lounge, the whole thing, El Al. And there he is, crammed into steerage, you know, between the crying baby and the snoring man, and he's cramped in there, and he feels bad. How come this guy's collecting stuff? He's so poor. He gets first class ticket. So he understands, frequent flyer. You pay the same amount of money, but if you earn points, you get the first class seat. You can be upgraded with no money. So even the people who fly fancy, fly in first class, doesn't mean they're so rich. We shouldn't judge. The Belzer Rav has a beautiful pshat regarding Dalakoff's chus. I'll read to you his words. He says, Shalakol Yehudi Yesh Chelek B'Torah HaKadosha HaMechavim Kenegdo. Every Jew, buried within every Jew, is a portion of the Holy Torah that is parallel to him. And when we do not understand our friends, and we deride them, chas v'shalom, lo yuchal lahavin gam es chelek haTorah shekineged chavero. We also therefore are prevented from understanding the Torah that is parallel to our friends. What does this mean? The Torah is not just a book of information and stories. Everything in the world is a Torah. When we study Tanakh, we study Chumash, we study Gemara, we study Navi, we study Medrash, that's Torah. When we go out and we study the world at large, we study God's creation, we study nature, we study science, we see the beauty of Hashem's majestical world, that's Torah also. And when we understand and appreciate all the human beings that God created, that's Torah also. Torah is not just a book. Torah is the entire world. And just like we have an obligation to study as much Torah, the text, as possible, we also have the obligation to study as much Torah people as possible. Every person has to be understood. You can't just look at someone fleetingly and say, that person is a good person, that person is a bad person, that person is a Rasha, that person is a Tzaddik. Rather, just like we take the time to analyze every Torah text carefully, we also must take the time to analyze every Torah person carefully. And if we don't do that, we will thereby be prevented from understanding the Torah text. Every person has a parallel in the text of Torah, and to understand Hashem's Torah, we must give everyone the benefit of the doubt first, being down the kafskos. In other words, we have to have that optimistic view of humanity. If we go around thinking everyone's bad, then we'll have miserable lives as well. The pasuk was b'tzedek tishpor amitacha, with justice you should judge your neighbor. The Targum Onkelos, the Aramaic translation of the Torah, translates the word b'tzedek in a very strange fashion. He translated it as b'kushta. B'kushta means in truth. In truth, you should judge your neighbor. What truth? And the truth is that deep down inside, every Jew does not want to sin. Deep down inside, under all those layers, every Jew is a tzaddik. What we see on the surface is falsehood. If you want to know how every Jew really is, you look deep down inside. Bekushta. Bekushta tishpar amitacha. The truth, we look at the truth of a person. We look at the totality of a person. We look at kol ha'adam. And that's what enables us to judge that person favorably. When we see someone doing something bad, it's sheker. It's falsehood. Deep down inside in the person is that pintel yid, that pure spark that would never want to do anything wrong. We have to find that spark. We have to appreciate humanity. So let me share with you the following mashal and nearing a conclusion. It's a mashal that I saw in the Sefer Sichos HaHischaskos, a book of Chizuk about the mitzvah of Dan Chaskos. Following story. Father has educated his son to appreciate and love Torah. Every day he tells his son, the Torah is the most precious thing in the world, the Torah is more precious than gold and silver, the Torah is more precious than any gem in the world, there's nothing better in the world, there's nothing more precious than Torah. The son takes this literally, appreciates Torah very much. And the next day, the son goes to a candy store, picks up a chocolate bar, and gives to the shopkeeper, and says to the shopkeeper, you know, I don't have any money, but I'm going to tell you over a Mishnah, which is as precious as gold and silver, and I'll take the chocolate, okay? Because after all, my father taught me that Torah is worth gold and silver. It's better than gold and silver. So therefore, since you wouldn't want coins, I'm going to tell you a Mishnah instead, and I'll take the Hershey bar. Shopkeeper, you know, push the kid aside, you're crazy, don't bother me, go home. How about this? How about you go home, give me money, I'll give you the chocolate bar. Because I don't operate with this Mishnah system, I operate with US dollars. Okay, the kid goes home, he's crestfallen. He's shattered. My father taught me that Torah is more precious than anything in the world. But no one believes him. You know, the shopkeeper wouldn't part with a measly chocolate bar for a Mishnah. So it must not be true. He goes to his father, tells his father what happens. The father is despondent also, and he needs to think of something to teach his son a lesson. So he goes down to the basement, opens up the safe. He takes out from the safe a pearl. A pearl that he inherited from his mother. One little pearl. And he says, let's go see how much this pearl is worth. They go back to the candy store and they offer the guy, you know, how much would you give me for this pearl? A pearl, I'll give you $5 for that pearl. They go to the vegetable store and they ask the vegetable man, then how many bananas, how many cucumbers would you give me for this pearl? I'll give you 10 cucumbers, 10 bananas for that pearl. They go to the pizza store, how many slices would you give me for this pearl? I'll give you 2 pies. And every time they go to these shopkeepers, they're offered, you know, various amounts for the pearl. Then the father takes him to a jewelry store. And the gemologist takes his little microscope and his little glasses, and he looks carefully at the pearl. Oh, this pearl is worth $1,000. I'll give you $1,000 for this pearl. And the father says to his son, you see, only an expert, only a maven, only one who really knows his field can appreciate the value of a pearl. And so too with Torah. Only an expert in the field, only a maven of Torah can appreciate the value of a Mishnah. The candy store guy, the pizza guy, the vegetable guy, they can't appreciate anything. They can't appreciate a pearl, they can't appreciate a Mishnah. It's not their field. You have to become a maven in Torah to understand its value. And the same thing is true for the Jewish people. In order to appreciate and understand the value of a Jew, what a Jew is worth, you have to be a maven. You have to be an expert in what a Jew is all about. You have to be, just like you have gemologists who are experts in diamonds and pearls, every Jew has to be an expert in what the value of a Jew is. If we would only appreciate and only understand and internalize how precious every Jewish soul is, then we would have no choice but to judge them favorably. If we don't appreciate what a Jew is, then what are they worth? A candy bar, some vegetables, you know, a couple of slices of pizza. That's what a Jew is worth. But an expert in Jews has to then see the redeeming value, the redeeming quality in every person. So that's what a sustained few weeks of ACT and Damit Chatzchus is there to do. It's there to transform us into Mevinim, into Mavens, into experts in the field of what a Jew is worth. The details are in the books. But the overwhelming philosophy has to be the value of each Jew. I'll close with a story I heard from Rabbi Horowitz, a colleague of mine from RPRY, whose wife's grandfather was the great Rav Shimon Schwab. Rav Shimon Schwab was the rabbi in Washington Heights of the Breuer's community, and who passed away in the 1980s, I believe. And he told the following story to his children, which I share with you now. There was an upstanding member of the Breuer Shul in Washington Heights who was actually in charge of the, he was a chairperson in charge of the catering done in the shul. And one day, Rav Schwab was on the subway and he looked out of his window and he saw this very man running into McDonald's and chomping down on a Big Mac in McDonald's. Rav Schwab could not believe his eyes. Erlich Hayid, an upstanding Jew, one who is a chazan in the shul, in charge of the kitchen in the shul, and upstanding member of the community, great Baal Tzedakah, he's eating a big... I can't believe this is true. Rav Schwab did not tell another soul about what he had seen. And he refused to believe that this is possible. And the man continued doing everything he did in the shul, and serving the public, Tzarchei Tzibur. 6 years later, Rav Schwab was visiting someone in the hospital, a woman from the shul in the hospital, and he was walking by a room and he sees this man from the subway in bed in the hospital. I didn't know you were here. Rav Schwab goes in to visit the man. The man says, "Oh, I never told you, but I have a horrible problem. I have horrible ulcers. I've had ulcers for 20 years. And usually I'm fine, but I just had a flare-up. I had to go to the hospital. Usually I'm fine because the doctor told me that whenever I feel the pain coming on, whenever I feel the ulcers exploding in my stomach, the only way to cure it is to eat meat. The only thing I can do is to eat meat. If I don't eat meat, I will die. That's what the doctor said. It's pikuach nefesh. And the truth is, I always have meat on me. I carry a little salami, a little beef jerky in my briefcase on the way to work, and I always have meat just in case my stomach flares up. But it happens to be, you know, I've only had a problem one time. One time, about 6 years ago, I forgot the salami at home. And I felt the pains coming on in the subway. And I opened my briefcase, and I saw there was no meat there. So, Rav Schwab, I had no choice, but I was going to die. The ulcers were about to explode. I ran to McDonald's, and I bought a Big Mac, and I shoved it down my face. And I feel so bad about it, but you know, no one knows about it. But I feel like a sinner for all these years. So I'm just unburdening myself to you right now. Rav Schwab said, "Baruch Hashem, I was dang l'chafschus. Baruch Hashem that I didn't tell anyone about this. I didn't stop you from being the shul caterer. I didn't stop you from getting your aliyos and serving as the chazan. But rather, I kept it to myself. And now you have vindicated yourself before me, and I'm so appreciative to you. And please, don't feel that you're a sinner. It was pikuach nefesh. It was a life saving thing. And therefore, you had every right, and I would have done the same, eaten that Big Mac if it would have saved my life. Being down the chafschus." So we have a Rav, we have Aselach Rav, we have a Rav to look at in order to best do this. And we need these role models because judging favorably is not a natural act. It's very difficult. We naturally think the worst of people. It's a lifetime struggle. And once again, we have to be biased. We have to be subjective. We have to have an agenda, and the agenda is positive. If we expect God to judge us favorably, then starts here tonight in the quorum of the mind. So I wish you all much luck and hatzlacha in as we grow together as a community in being down the cosmos. Thank you.